From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit Public Schools blows a deadline and misses out on $4 million in Head Start funding.
When you are a broke school district, you can't give back $400, let alone $4 million. It's just terrible.
Is higher education becoming too politicized? What's at stake if we can't exchange different views in a college classroom?
If the universities fail to lead in this area, what hope is there out in the society? I mean, we don't want, you know, Fox versus MSNBC to be the norm, the cultural norm.
And dangerous rogue waves on the Great Lakes, it's happened.
You know, it's possible to generate a 10-foot high meteor tsunami wave.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. More than 120,000 of America's veterans are waiting too long for health care from the VA. That's according to an internal Veterans Administration audit released this week. That audit noted a failing scheduling system, making it nearly impossible for veterans to get timely health care. And here in Michigan, three VA facilities have been flagged for a closer look. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what could be happening at these facilities? And will this audit be a wake-up call for the VA? But first, one state lawmaker says it's kind of like controlling very large purse strings with very little accountability. Since 2011, more than $65 million in state money have been awarded to businesses all over Michigan, all on the signatures of just two individuals. Is this a worrisome lack of transparency, or is it a good effort by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation to be nimble, to be able to get state incentives into the hands of businesses and help them grow and strengthen Michigan's economy? Chris Gouts reported on this for Crane's Detroit Business. Chris, how does this process called delegated authority work?
Well, when you talk to the MEDC, they say that it works exactly the same way as it does when the Michigan Strategic Fund, which is the public board that approves other incentive projects. The only difference is that it depends on who actually does the final approval, whether or not it's two individuals or if it's the full board during a public meeting. But all of the projects get vetted exactly the same way. They say they go through all the rigmarole of lawyers looking at the backgrounds of the individuals in the company, that the company itself, they look through the financials. They give it all the same due diligence, but it's sometimes it's approved in private and sometimes it's approved in public.
And is there a cap on how much can be approved in private?
It's anything $1 million or less. And so the majority of the projects that have been approved since 2011, when this change was authorized, most of the projects have been this way. But it's obviously less money overall because the other projects that get approved by the full board are for more than $1 million. And so it's a much higher amount.
And who is allowed to sign off on these smaller projects?
Well, it's one of three individuals. So it's primarily it's Mike Finney, who is the head of the MEDC and also serves as chair of the Michigan Strategic Fund Board. And then it could also be the state treasurer or his or her designee. And then also the strategic fund manager, which right now is Mark Moranti, who's serving on an interim basis. But before that, it was someone else. So it's two of the three individuals have to sign off on it. But if any, they did build some safeguards into it. So if any one of the three has some sort of question about it, they can have veto power over the whole thing. And that project would then have to be sent to the full board if one of the three disagree with that.
Chris, who have you talked to who's maybe a little uneasy about this?
It's mostly lawmakers, but they also are quick to point out that there haven't been any problems. I mean, there's no scandal here. It's just a process that most people don't understand how it works, and the MEDC doesn't really promote or explain, you know, how this is getting done. So, and even though if a project is approved in private by the two individuals signing off on it, all of them are given press releases that and put out there for the public. So it's not like we never know who's getting public money, but they do get press releases put out afterwards. Sometimes it could be upwards of a month afterwards. But there are some questions of transparency that lawmakers have raised.
And does this happen in other states? What do other states do when it comes to approving business incentives?
It's kind of all over the map. What I found in just trying to reach out to some neighboring states, Ohio has a public board that approves all of them. And then Indiana, what they do is they have a $3 million threshold, and the vast, vast majority of projects are approved through a delegated process like we have. And so we're kind of right in the middle if you look at those two states. I don't know nationwide how this is done, but it's something that's fairly new to Michigan. It was done on a much smaller level, as I understand it, during the Granholm years. There were just a few of the incentive packages that the MEDC had that were allowed to be done this way, and it doesn't sound like it was done to the extent that it's being done now.
And so why do we think that there's more of it now? What are you hearing as far as why it's much more common now?
One thing is that the business community loves it. And, you know, how it's done isn't really a concern to them. But what they like about it is that the MEDC is moving much faster. When I talked to Mike Finney about this, he said, you know, the problem that we still hear over and over again is that we don't move fast enough. And so from the business point of view, you know, how this really helps them is, say you're a small manufacturer and a customer comes to you and wants you to do work for them, but it might mean having to add in a whole new production line or expanding physically your plant or hiring a whole bunch of people right away to be able to meet the orders. They can go to the MEDC and say, look, we've got this real time sensitive thing going on. You know, we would love to get an incentive so we can get this moving. And this allows them to speed up that process by anywhere from a couple of days to, you know, several weeks or maybe even close to a month if they missed the last board meeting. So the business community sees this as a great thing that the MEDC is doing, that they're getting rid of several layers of bureaucracy, and they can just do the kind of things that they know that the board would approve anyway. This just allows them to move faster and to meet the needs of the business community.
Chris Gouts writes for Crane's Detroit Business. As always, great to talk with you, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are the liberal arts becoming too politicized? Are politics and political ideology taking too strong a hold on higher education? A growing number of academics worry the answer may be yes. With that in mind, there's a three-day summit coming up at Grand Valley State University. It's billed as a meeting of minds left and right, designed to explore these questions. Joining us again on Stateside is Gleaves Whitney, who's director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. It is always good to have you on the program, Gleaves.
Thank you so much.
Hasn't higher ed always been somewhat political? Why is it a problem now?
It has always been political. You've always had the tug of wars. You can go back to the McCarthy era. You know, in the 1980s, you also had political correctness really kind of rear its ugly head. But recently, this has made the news because of a spate of disinvitations to commencement speakers and also some ugly incidents on campuses where speakers have actually been shouted down. Now, of course, you can make one case that, you know, students have always protested, but I'm more of the school that I think, you know, if we go back to the hallowed ways of protesting, civil protests from Henry David Thoreau and, you know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi and the teach-ins in the 1960s at the University of Michigan taught the nation, there are ways of protesting that are civil, that make the point, and that really encourage further dialogue as opposed to shutting people up.
Give us an example, some of the examples of these cancellations. Who's getting disinvited?
Well, recently, there's been a lot of press about what's happened this year at Brandeis, Haverford, Rutgers, Smith. For example, Condoleezza Rice felt that she had to pull out of the invitation that she had received from Rutgers as a commencement speaker because it had gotten really hostile, the comments that she was receiving. Last year, it happened at Swarthmore and, or I'm sorry, still this year, Swarthmore and Johns Hopkins. And, you know, it's, I think, a trend that has been spiking recently. And Michael Bloomberg just made a pretty big issue of this when he spoke at Harvard at their commencement address just a few weeks ago. And he said that he's really regretting seeing free speech shut down in the very institutions where you need to be able to explore contrarian ideas. And he said, you know, to the students there at Harvard, he said, on too many college campuses, people aren't listening to facts that run counter to their ideology. They're fearing them. They're just reacting to them. And that's not an appropriate response at a university where we're trying to train the rising generation, educate them into seeing how to deal with these diverse cultures and the ideas that come out of those different cultures and deal with them respectfully and in an engaging way.
If liberal arts are becoming too politicized, what are the consequences in higher education from this?
Overall, I think when we politicize the liberal arts, when we're saying that questions, that the sort of the big questions about justice, what is truly freedom? Is freedom achieved best in community, or is it just an individual thing, as John Locke said? We need a safe place to explore these ideas as a culture. The liberal arts have always been the disciplines that have helped guide the culture to make it better because people were equipped, mentally equipped, to engage in that kind of conversation and not just reduce everything to politics.
How do we promote constructive and principled discourse between left and right when you're looking at the liberal arts and you're looking what's happening on campuses? How does this happen?
You know, I know a lot of professors on the left and the right who do love the discourse in the liberal arts. And I think it's, rather than just always migrating to the people who grab the headlines, it's great to have the opportunity, and this is what we're trying to do with this summit, starting on Wednesday and going through Friday here on the downtown campus at Grand Valley. We're trying to host a summit where people from all different backgrounds have a voice, have a say in what the liberal arts really is. A liberal education recovers our humanity to us when it's been bombarded by really some of the crude, pamphleteering that you hear in other outlets. So we're trying to provide a place where these professors, administrators, students, grad students can come together and say, yes, that's what drew me to the liberal arts in the first place, those questions about justice and what freedom really is. What is the meaning of equality in a democracy? Can we, as President Ford used to say, since I'm speaking from Grand Rapids, mm-hmm. can we disagree without being disagreeable?
Gleiz Whitney is director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. A meeting of minds, left and right, will be held June 11th through the 13th at GVSU. Gleiz, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There you are, soaking up the sun on a beautiful Lake Michigan beach in Holland. Suddenly, huge waves begin racing ashore. The waves and the undertow pull people out into the lake. Does it sound like a disaster movie? Well, it has happened along the Great Lakes, and those freak waves have left drowned victims in their wake. Dr. David Schwab is a Great Lakes research scientist with the University of Michigan Water Center. David, there was a recent piece in Michigan History looking at these fatal waves and talked about incidents in 1917, 1929, 1938, and other times. And it used a term that I don't think most of us had ever heard before, a seiche. What is that?
A seiche is a standing wave that occurs in a closed basin of water. So you can think of a bathtub mm-hmm. as a good example where the water is going up at one end and down at the other and sloshing back and forth.
Yes.
It occurs in lakes, closed bodies of water, and can be caused by wind or sometimes actually seismic activity. And the way you see it is water level going up in one part of the lake and down in another part of the lake, sloshing back and forth, if you will.
So practically speaking, just like these historic accounts from the beginning of the 20th century, people are on a beach on a nice day, but something freaky can happen even in Wisconsin and send that wave rolling over to Holland?
I think the more dangerous phenomena is a very specific type of a seiche-like oscillation, not the whole water body sloshing back and forth, but a single wave that's developed as a meteorological disturbance moves across a lake. This type of phenomena can occur even on an open ocean coast. It doesn't have to be in a closed basin. So you can think of it more of as a progressive wave than a standing wave. And the latest description we use for that type of phenomena is called a medio tsunami. And that means like a meteorological tsunami. So it has really more in common with a tsunami wave than the seiche motion of a whole lake, although they're related.
Okay, they're like cousins.
Yes.
And how big can these waves be?
Oh, gosh.
I can tell from your face you're impressed.
Yeah.
Respectful.
Yeah, easily 10 feet. You know, it's possible to generate a 10-foot high meteo tsunami wave.
And is that, like, I'm thinking of, we have, I'm lucky enough to have a cottage on the southwest coast of Ireland, and I know there there's a plaque up at a local beach talking, and it's to people who died when a rogue wave. Is that what we would tend to call a rogue wave?
That could well have been a meteo tsunami.
Yeah.
And they depend on the strength and, what do I want to say, the movement of a meteorological disturbance like a squall line coming across the water. It has to be moving at exactly the right speed to amplify the wave. So if the meteorological disturbance and the wave are moving at the same speed, you can get a really big meteo tsunami. But, of course, you can have smaller ones, too.
Sure. Now, have we had any of these happening in recent history that you're aware of along any of the Great Lakes?
They occur commonly, three or four a year on each lake, as far as we can tell, but maybe not such big ones. Mm. You know, they might only be a foot or a foot and a half. And oftentimes they occur during periods when there's high waves, too, because of the squall line, the wind coming across, and you might not notice it, a foot or a foot and a half rise in water level. So they're, much more common than you think.
And so any of the Great Lakes could have this happen?
Exactly.
And does.
Yeah, and does. Yeah.
Well, when we civilians hear that word tsunami, we think of, for example, the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 or the Sendai tsunami off the coast of Japan in 2011 that led to the Fukushima nuclear disaster. So how much damage could these meteo tsunamis or seiches cause along our shoreline?
I think if it happened in the right place, you could have problems with boats and marinas. I've heard of cars getting flooded from these things occurring. There was one in Lake Erie year before last, that damaged a car and turned a boat over, you know, that kind of thing.
Do we have better ways of knowing that these are coming? For example, the stories that we see about here in the Michigan history, clearly people had no idea this was coming. They were having a nice day, you know, waiting at the Holland Beach, and suddenly they're being washed out. But do we have a way of knowing these are coming, or is this just a whoa?
Yeah. So my career has been spent doing research on oceanography in the Great Lakes, and really it's only since the 1950s or 60s that we started to understand what caused these waves. Before that, it was much as you said, that people would see the water level rising and had no idea why that was happening. But we learned that they're usually associated with a squall line coming across the lake in the right direction and the right speed. The Weather Service has become much better at recognizing the conditions that could generate a tsunami or a meteo tsunami and actually issuing warnings for people about those conditions.
And just one more reminder that people do need to pay attention to those warnings. It doesn't always happen, does it?
Exactly.
Boaters and folks on the beach. David Schwab, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. David Schwab is with the University of Michigan Water Center, and he is a Great Lakes oceanographer. Why is it that one product will resonate with a group of consumers while a similar one just can't quite catch on? It's a sort of dilemma you can imagine Don Draper and Peggy Olson trying to hash out in an episode of Mad Men. And it turns out it was a dilemma for a major tobacco company trying to figure out why Detroit smokers were so loyal to the competition. In this case, Cool cigarettes in the 1970s. Steve Neveling is an investigative journalist who discovered this bit of tobacco and marketing history and wrote about it for Motor City Muckraker. Hi, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What led you to look at this piece of smoking and marketing history from 40 years ago?
Well, I was actually just doing some research on the connection between marijuana use and cool cigarettes, and I noticed that there was a recently archived letter from an executive from Philip Morris who had actually written about this very subject while coming to Detroit in the early 1970s to determine why people were so loyal to cool cigarettes.
you find this letter, a guy named Al Udall writing. He works for Philip Morris, and he's writing basically to the boss. Was he testing Detroiters' responses to the possible potential product that Philip Morris wanted to put up against Kohl's, which, by the way, we should note was made by competitor R.J. Reynolds?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And Philip Morris actually really wanted a piece of this market, and because Kohl's was really taking off at the time. They had a large African-American section. At the time, Philip Morris considered the hip crowd or the in crowd. And they had their own figure out. They wanted to figure out if Detroiters would consider changing from Kohl's, their favorite cigarette, to something that they called menthol fat. And Detroiters just hated the idea. They thought that menthol fats had a negative connotation because of the word fat. So women didn't like that association.
I can imagine then, that's true. I wouldn't like it either.
Yeah, I can't. It was a very odd name. And another Detroiters has said, because this cigarette was a little bit wider than your typical menthol cigarette. So people would thought this wouldn't be very relaxing. You get too much of a blast of menthol. So they overwhelmingly said there's no way they would smoke the cigarette.
What was the connection with pot smoking and Kohl's cigarettes?
Well, this is according to Philip Morris, and they found that there was this very strong correlation between Kohl's customers and marijuana smokers. And they weren't really able to figure out what exactly it was, but people who whom they spoke with about smoking Kohl's also spoke about liking marijuana, and when Philip Morris said, "Well, why do you like to smoke Kohl's cigarettes so much with marijuana?" and they said, "You know, it's refreshing. It takes away the cotton feeling in the throat. That it even has a sort of reefer-like smell to it." And they even liked to take the Kohl tobacco and mix it up with marijuana and smoke it in a joint. So there was a very loyal audience when it came to both smoking pot and, well, I should say, there's a strong correlation between pot smokers at the time and Kohl's cigarettes. And the interesting thing about this research that they did is they found out that Kohl's smokers were overwhelmingly on the lower socioeconomic rung, and that a lot of these people that they spoke with started smoking cigarettes at the age of 10 years old. And the average, I think they said, it was around 15 years old. So you had these kids who were growing up, were taught to like Kohl's, they thought it was the hip thing to do. And you had, you know, essentially a Southern white executive coming up here trying to figure out, how can we be the in crowd in Detroit? And there's no way they could figure it out.
And did Philip Morris ever manage to crack that Detroit market?
No, it doesn't really look like they did. It's unclear what they ever did with this study, if they did anything, but in the letter they said, we don't know what action, if any, we can take based on this information. And, you know, in Detroit, Newports are very popular, which is not a Philip Morris brand. So at some point, Kohl's sort of gave way to Newports in the Detroit market.
What do you think this all says about the culture of Detroit in the 1970s?
I think that people in the 1970s, and I've talked to a lot of people about the story after this who experienced and went through the 1970s and smoked Kohl cigarettes. It was a new age, and you know, people were beginning to loosen up and listening to new kinds of music. And marijuana was becoming available. And also unique that you had a predominantly this was a product that was predominantly appealed to African Americans. And that's something that people still can't figure out why that's the case. But interestingly enough, it's a really interesting cultural effect in Detroit.
Are Kohl's still big today, or has that moment waned?
Yeah, Kohl's has diminished quite a bit. In fact, it's hard to find Kohl's smokers anymore. You'll find among menthol smokers, you'll find mostly Newport. Maybe you'll see some Marlboro menthols, but Kohl's cigarettes definitely aren't the in cigarette anymore. If there even is an in cigarette anymore in Detroit.
Steve Neveling is an investigative journalist who wrote for Motor City Muckraker, looking into Detroit smokers' love affair with cool cigarettes in the 1970s. Steve, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If you have the sense your house is becoming increasingly crammed with stuff, maybe it's time to declutter, and that could mean a garage sale. Now, if you do it right, a garage sale can be a total win-win. You get rid of stuff you don't really need anymore, and you get money. Writer Mickey Maynard not only trolls her way through garage and estate sales around the country, she holds garage sales at her Ann Arbor home two or three times a year. Mickey, what's the most important step to take in having a garage sale that'll get rid of the stuff and make me some money?
One of the things you have to do is decide what you can live without. And that's very hard for a lot of people. However, I'm actually in the process of moving, and I will be having a moving sale. And it's shocking how much stuff you have in your basement that you just put down there and don't look at. So
tote from move to move. That's what we've been
doing. Rule number one, if you haven't opened the box from the last move, if you haven't used it in 3 years or so, if you don't have something coming up, put it in the garage sale pile.
What about just the way you display the merchandise and the way, the feel of your garage sale?
I learned the retail business at Jacobson's. I worked there when I was in high school and college and a little bit after college. Mm-hmm. So I understand how retailing works. I put things out on tables. I price everything. I have bins of dollar items, little items for 10 cents that a kid can buy. If they have a quarter, they can come in and they can get a toiletry from the Hyatt Hotel or a little toy or a deck of cards or something like that. Then for the more valuable items, I try to be kind of, if I were going to an auction, what would I pay at an auction? And obviously at an auction, the dealers want to be able to double the markup. So I kind of price it 30 to 40%. And then what will happen is dealers come first. They know that I've got a fair price on it, and they're willing to buy it. People who aren't educated are probably going to be a little bit out of luck at garage sales.
Early bird gets the worm.
Exactly.
Do you start? Are you there at the stroke of 8 o'clock, or do you get knocks on the door? Your face. Do they knock on the door before you start?
I always say in my sale, you know, no early sales. My sales are generally 9 to about 2, but there's as soon as we open the garage door, there are people that stream into the driveway. I try to discourage that, but at this point, there's nothing you can do.
You want to sell.
And also what does kind of tick me off a little bit is the prices that are set first thing in the morning, you shouldn't be asking for a cut down from those. And I do get irritated with dealers who swoop in and try to undercut my already low prices.
So hold your ground, at least in the morning. You might talk differently if it's 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
My strategy is pretty much that prices hold until about noon or 1 o'clock, and then I'll mark everything half. And you should see the stuff flow out after 1 o'clock. Actually, people haven't really caught on to that, but if you show up at my garage sale after 1, I'm going to make you a great deal.
What they call a fire sale. The blue light special is at it.
Or the shopping bag special.
And you like to play music and just kind of give it a sense of fun.
Yes, my friend Sandy Hang is a great garage sale giver, and she has a mix that's called Sell My Stuff. So I took a tip from Sandy and I put a playlist together. I would like to put on Michigan radio, but I don't want people stopping to listen to car talk. So I will put on Motown. I'll put on dance music from the 80s. I'll put on things that people are really get them in a good mood.
Yeah, very good. Well, and if it doesn't sell,
okay. So if it doesn't sell, a couple of options. I mean, when I have the luxury, I know I'm going to be having more garage sales. So I'll box things up and put them back in the garage for the next sale. And sometimes it takes 2 or 3 or even 4 sales for things to sell. After about 4 sales, that's it. It's got to go to Purple Heart or Goodwill or Salvation Army. The point is to get rid of stuff. So you have to get rid of it at that point.
True micro commerce right in your own driveway.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Mickey.
My pleasure.
On yesterday's show, we told you how you could buy your very own plane through an online auction for the Detroit Public Schools. Well, if a plane doesn't grab you, how about a boxing ring or a scoreboard, maybe a pretzel warmer? These are just a few of the thousands of items now being auctioned off from the Pontiac Silverdome in Oakland County. The former home of the Detroit Lions and Detroit Pistons has been unused and decaying for years now, and the current owner is hoping to get whatever's left inside sold before it's too late. Other items up for grabs include flat-screen TVs and, wait for it, a soccer field. The auction begins today and runs through June 19th. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you are a school district where more than 80% of your students live in poverty, every penny that helps those students is critical. That's why there's been a collective gasp of disbelief, even anger, with the news that Detroit Public Schools has blown $4 million in Head Start funding. The reason? DPS missed the federal application deadline. A school spokesperson blamed a technical problem in uploading the application. Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley joins us now. That $4 million supported about 900 students in 56 classrooms in this just-completed school year. And the district's spokesperson says, not to worry, we'll use state money from the Great Start Readiness Program. We'll use federal Title I money. And we're going to expand early childhood programming to 3,900 little ones next year, up about 600 kids. Do you believe this?
It sounds like a bridge in Arizona. I mean, literally. I couldn't even call people and talk about this on the phone because there wasn't language that I could use, not even with my friends. There have been a lot of things that have happened with the city and with the school district, which are both broke and have emergency managers, that make you just shake your head. But this is the kind of thing that you go, okay, enough. Now it's really time to shut down this school system, get rid of everybody there, let the competent people reapply for their jobs and start doing things for these children that they deserve. There is nothing short of, you can't have a computer glitch without some fingers being attached to it. So the first thing you know is that somebody waited until the last minute to risk funding for these kids. Even if they're able to fix this, even if they can find 3,900 slots, that two things will happen. One is that the federal government will say, oh, well, then you don't really need $4 million, so we won't give this to you the next time. Or two, it's just not true, and some of these kids are going to be left out.
And the fact that this happened a year ago, and it was because of a story in Bridge Magazine, finding it a year later. So no one had stepped up. It was just this line item was not in the upcoming school budget. Why is that? Oh, well, we had a technical glitch uploading things.
I just think that the type of things that happen in a company or in an agency or any place that happen, you go, oh, God, that's too bad. Except when it's a company or an agency that deals with children, it is not acceptable. You can't have the same level of excuses. You shouldn't have them anywhere. But okay, let's say you run a company that makes widgets and you have a problem. Oh, geez, we messed up. Let's fix this. You can't do that when you're dealing with children. You have to be three times as careful, three times as diligent. You can't wait until the last minute to do anything, particularly when you know you've had problems in the past. This is the same problem that the actual city of Detroit had with federal funding, where they'd miss deadlines or turn in applications wrong and lose out on millions of dollars in federal funding. When you are a broke school district, you can't give back $400, let alone $4 million. It's just terrible.
Well, and I had to get your thoughts on the fact that the timing of this, just when we had this kind of sense of let's all work together to get Detroit back on the road to recovery. You had state lawmakers joining in to approve the grand bargain. You had people saying we are from, you know, Detroit, Michigan. Do you worry this group is going to get the naysayers all tuned up again? Here we go. Detroit can't figure out how to do anything.
You know, there's some legislator in West Michigan going, man, I knew we shouldn't have approved that money. That has nothing to do with this.
Right.
But it is that same persona, that same thing that people worry about that makes people not want to give. I have people literally to call me all the time. I want to help the kids of Detroit. I'm not writing a check to DPS. What can I do? And the DPS Foundation exists to help with that. But, you know, that shouldn't be the problem, not when you're trying to help kids. That shouldn't be what people are worried about or an obstacle to helping kids. And yet here we go again. If you're talking about the type of incompetence that leads to that, that will make it – that's the third thing – will make it, you know, less likely for people to help.
Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry, in his commentary today, he noted that these are kids for whom education is the only hope. And he says, once again, DPS has let them down, and the district doesn't even seem to care. What are your thoughts on what's been said or not said so far by DPS officials?
I couldn't believe the excuses. You know, if it was a technical glitch, I would never have told somebody that. I would not have publicly put that in a statement and said, oh, this was a technical glitch. What I would have said was, we did something terribly wrong. We will not have it happen again. And these are the people we fired. You know, but it's almost sort of aloof, an aloofness like, oh, we screwed up, but we're going to figure it out. And we're going to get these kids in all kinds of other programs and it'll be fine. That's not the attitude when you're talking about kids. It's not, well, we'll get our widgets from someplace else.
Yeah. Now, we know that this happened under the watch of the previous emergency manager, Roy Roberts. So it happened a couple of months before current EM Jack Martin was appointed. So who should be stepping up besides the official mouthpiece of the Detroit Public Schools?
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing, I know Roy Roberts, a former GM exec who worked really hard to turn some things around. I'm wondering if he knew. If they didn't bother to tell anybody until they had to put it in the budget and say, okay, we're going from $4 million to zero, that's the kind of thing that, again, is just, that's not what you do. They should have made an announcement as soon as it happened. They should have started asking for funding from people as soon as it started. We've had a terrible, you know, faux pas here at DPS, and we need people to please help us fill this in. There are folks who, for kids, low-income kids, particularly for Head Start, they could have given millions of dollars to Matrix Human Services and said, we need you to put more kids in your program, because they're not going to write a check to DPS, but we could have made sure that we got that money. There are people who have that money. This is the most giving, literally, region in the country. People believe in the institutions and in the things that are important here. There's nothing more important than kids. There's just not.
What should we look for going forward, and what should we take away from this?
Well, I think that there's got to be some serious vigilance about what happens with these particular kids and whether they're actually able to do what they're saying about getting them in programs.
As in hold their feet to the fire
this
promise of we'll have
I'm going to be calling Matrix saying, okay, you said that we can take kids. Are you going to take 3,900? If you're not, how many are you take? I'm going to find out if these 3,900 kids all get in a program. That's number one. But the next thing is to really decide how you change the paradigm of how we teach kids, how we work to make sure they get what they need. If it's not a school district like that, then it's something different. If this school district cannot work, then we cannot continue to pretend like it is. And if we want it to work, then we have to make sure that there are people there who know how to do that. And we can't continue every year hoping that it's going to get better. We need to make it better.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Thanks, Rochelle.
Thank you.
The controversy over long wait times and improper scheduling practices at Veterans Administration hospitals and clinics has cost the job of VA Secretary Eric Shinseki. And it led to an internal VA audit of healthcare facilities. And that, in turn, has caused the VA to flag three of its facilities in Michigan for a closer look. What might be happening at these facilities, and what does this mean to veterans in Michigan? For this conversation, we're joined by Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we are joined by Dr. Joe Schwartz, retired naval officer, physician, or former Republican congressman from West Michigan. These days, he's a visiting lecturer at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, even as he continues to practice medicine. Dr. Schwartz, congressman, whichever, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Todd, bring us up to date on this VA access audit and tell us what facilities in Michigan were flagged.
Sure. Here on Monday, the Veterans Administration released this access audit where they went out and they talked to officials in about 730 different facilities across the country. And what they found in Michigan was that three, one in Ann Arbor, one in Lansing, one in Muskegon, were flagged for further review. We really haven't heard much more than that in terms of why they would have been flagged. And quite frankly, the people at those facilities are very confused as to why they were flagged in the first place. But it is part of this. And these guys were targeted as among being the worst of the worst. I don't mean just these three.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the group that they want the closest look at in terms of why are veterans having trouble getting the appointments they need at these facilities.
And it's clinics in Lansing, Muskegon, and then that big hospital in Ann Arbor. I've been at that hospital. There are a lot of veterans that rely on that Ann Arbor hospital for a lot of health care.
Absolutely. Well, and it has, you can tell from looking at the numbers that it leads among the facilities in the state and in the region in terms of people who are waiting more than 30 days to get their appointments done, or waiting long periods of time to get their initial appointments, which is really what this audit is looking at.
Congressman, you served in the Navy in Southeast Asia. You served in the U.S. Congress. In 2007, you served on that Pentagon-appointed commission that investigated conditions at Walter Reed. Based on your experience, as this story unfolded over the long wait times and the shifty scheduling practices, were you at all surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised. The VA, you know, has a history replete with problems like this. I don't think there's any, malintent on anyone's part, but it is an organization that is probably too large, and it is not organized in ways that accomplish things efficiently. Now you have the numbers of veterans coming back, first from Iraq and Afghanistan, with traumatic brain injury, all of the problems that these particular wars brought with them, that are different from other wars, from my war, which was Vietnam, and they really have been unable to handle it. But if you look back at the history of the VA, going all the way back to when it was founded after World War I, they had problems. They had to kind of reinvent themselves again in 1930, and there have been complaints by veterans, and I think quite legitimate ones, that the VA simply is not able to handle the demand and the need for care. And here we go again. I think probably in the long run, the whole organization, the whole outfit, is going to have to somehow be taken apart and put back together, reorganized, because it doesn't work. And we have decades and decades of history showing when the demand becomes too high, the system starts to fall apart. So I'm glad Congress is taking a hard look at it. I hope the look is a constructive one, and not one just to get members in front of a camera and criticize the VA. Certainly there's a lot of criticism that can be given, but by golly, I think let's take a look at it and see how we can improve what we have, and it may take a whole new structure to do so.
Right. I was going to jump in here because I think what's missing part of this is no one's really questioning the fact that the VA tries to give great care to veterans. I don't think there's any question about that. The question is are they fooling around? Are they cooking the books in order to make it seem like they're not as busy or as delayed in terms of giving appointments to people as they clearly are? I mean, what we're really talking about here are people changing appointment dates in the VA system. And Congressman, please correct me if you know better than this, but it's my understanding that, you know, patients who call in are asked, when is your desired date to come in? 14 days, supposed to be within 14 days for new appointments. It's supposed to be within 30 days for people who have been previously seen. And that what we're seeing is people are actually going back in, people with the VA are going back in and changing what those desired dates were to make it appear as if they're not waiting as long. And that's an attempt, clearly, in some cases, to try to make the system in the VA look better than it really is. And I don't think that's helping anybody.
But and let me ask, in fact, I'm sure as a physician, you can give us some insight. If I was to call cold and ask for an appointment within 15 days, I wouldn't expect to get one. Is that an unrealistic standard, doctor?
I don't think it's an unrealistic standard. I think it's obvious that the VA is undermanned. That the non-professional, the non-medical folks at the VA were backing and filling as best they could. It's kind of tacky for me to say they got caught at it, but they did get caught at it, and it all points to the fact that something we've known for years, those of us who have dealt with the VA and had some knowledge of the VA and military medicine as well, because we learned a lot at Walter Reed in 2007. When the crunch comes, the capacity to take care of both active duty service people and veterans is really not there, and that's what needs to be fixed. And instead of going back and having a great recrimination about what's not being done, let's figure out what we do need to do. And I, quite frankly, I think it's quite obviously the thing's got to be taken apart, have some smart people come in and say, okay, here's a better way to put it together, knowing that they're going to have to be more doctors, paramedical personnel, nurses, facilities. I see the Senate yesterday said they're going to fund 26 more facilities, which is a step in the right direction. But this has got to be a wake-up call, and there have been others, Todd. I'll admit that absolutely and positively. But here's yet another wake-up call that something's got to be done. I feel badly for Eric Shinseki because I feel he is a great American, a fine American, a patriot, but this thing kind of crumbled around him.
Tad, what comes next? And especially here in Michigan, what do we watch for, knowing that these three facilities have been flagged?
Well, I think from a national point of view, what comes next here is that the VA will continue their audits. The Office of the Inspector General for the VA will also, is looking into this, is going to have more to say, like the congressman said. I mean, there's you know, heads roll? Yes. Will chests be beaten? Most definitely. Will there be congressional investigations? Absolutely. Will there be more money in a budget to do something about this? God only knows. As far as the ones in Michigan, we're still waiting. They're still waiting to find out what the heck happened. I mean, they were surprised to find out that they were on this list. And everything that I'm hearing from them is that they are still waiting to hear from either the Office of the Inspector General or the VA itself to tell them, here is what we heard. What we do know is that this is not just a simple matter of one person at these places saying, yes, I changed an appointment date or a desired date. The filters that they put on this, you know, these 112 facilities across the country that were flagged for further review were considered somehow more severe. We don't know how, but somehow more severe than the other places where this were done. What we're going to find out next is why.
Dr. Joe Schwartz, Congressman Joe Schwartz, physician, former Republican congressman from West Michigan, now a visiting lecturer at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. And he was joined by Detroit Free Press, Washington reporter Todd Spangler. Thanks so much to both of you for speaking with us. And I am sure that as this unfolds, we'll be talking more. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's program was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Stateside contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Saade, Kayla Steinberg, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.